Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your hosts, Jorn Vestai Vampyr and Jajim Tai Jajim, will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Welcome to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Book Review Podcast. I am Jajim.
And I am Jorn.
And today we are going to be actually looking at two books. We have been doing the Day of Honor series. Today, we are going to be finishing up that series with the last two books in the omnibus. And both titles are called Day of Honor, only the first one is by author Michael Jan Friedman, and it is a novelization of the Voyager episode of the same name, Day of Honor. The second book we're looking at today is Honor Bound. It is number 6 in the Day of Honor series compendium, and it was penned by Diana G. Gallagher. So, John, you want to give us a summary of our first book?
Polana Taurus has no intention of celebrating the Day of Honor, a day of glory for others of Klingon heritage. The day for Taurus has always been a dark one, for reasons that stretch back to her childhood memories she has tried to forget. This day of honor is no better. Trouble with the warp engines have crippled the USS Voyager, just as it confronts a deadly threat. Taurus and Tom Paris must put their lives on the line to restore the engines. With time running out, Taurus has one last chance to accept the great loss she once suffered and reveal her true feelings that she has buried for years.
Now, that's a good summary of the book, but that summary sure wouldn't work for the episode.
No, there's a lot more to the book, really, than was in the episode.
In the episode, I actually felt like the Milana's story was more of a subplot than the main plot. It seemed to me that the main plot focused more on Seven of Nine and her problems.
That's the direction Voyager was going. You had a lot of people getting a little bit upset at the producers of Star Trek Voyager for focusing so much on this slinky-clad character and keeping her in focus than on the stories that everybody else was doing. Couple that with the fact that from the latter days of Next Gen through DS9 into Voyager, you basically had an episode being two stories, a minor story with some of the characters, and then a major story with some of the other characters.
Yeah, that's definitely the way it was going. But they really, and especially now at this point, because Seven of Nine was a relatively new character. She had just been rehumanized, more or less, and there were a lot of doubts about her. And that's probably why it was focusing on her so much.
And that brings up the point, because she was so new as far as being humanized, that part of that particular main plot to the story was that Janeway wasn't sure that Seven of Nine didn't cause the problem that caused them to eject the warp core.
B'Elanna was sure she was, though.
Well, B'Elanna was paranoid about everybody.
Yeah. Well, she had a rough start. As it is outlined in this book, we start out, if I recall correctly, we start out with a reveal of what caused the aliens that were threatening Voyager so much problems. And they had been assimilated their entire race, with the exception of a very small handful of survivors, were assimilated by the Borg.
Well, let's take a step further back with the book. The book actually starts out with the breakup's parents and how she reacted to her father leaving.
Okay, that was first. Yeah, that was really sad. That was a sad thing to watch for a little girl, regardless of whether she's Klingon or human or a Klingon-human hybrid. She just kind of was witnessing the breakup of her family, and that had to be horrible.
And we never heard or saw what the issues were that were causing the breakup. There had to be a reason that the two of them got married, so there had to be reasons why the two of them couldn't get along.
Yeah, and that really wasn't revealed very, very much, was it?
Not at all.
Yeah. All right, so why don't we just launch right into your overall impressions of this book?
Well, it's book five of the series. I kind of like this particular book better than Michael Jan Friedman's other story in this world, her Klingon soul. I don't know if it was a matter of somebody had already plotted it out for him and he could just fill in some really good comprehensive details or what, but this one felt like a better volume. There were some additions from the episode in this book. Like I've already mentioned, the separation of her parents, her attempts to reconcile her feelings about the Day of Honor the year before, and you know, we never saw that, which is from her Klingon soul. And then the doctor stumbling into a still running Holosuite program, and all of a sudden sparks the desire in him to come up with his own holiday celebration.
I think that might have been just Mike stretching his creative muscle there a little bit.
I would have rather seen him stretch his creative muscle and go back and explain what happened with B'Elanna's parents.
Mm-hmm. Well, the doctor never showed up in the episode. Not at all. He was not involved with it at all. So I'm not sure why he got brought into it.
No, you're right. It really seemed like a distraction from the storyline that was going on. But I think what this book has done for a lot of people that are into Klingon fandom and wanting to do things at conventions or events or whatever is that he details, we saw the ceremony flash past us in the episode. But we can go back and we can take this book and we can document all the steps that go through the Day of Honor celebration if anyone wants to recreate that ceremony.
It was quite detailed, the descriptions of what was going to happen to B'Elanna. She never went through with all of it, but at the same time, definitely if one wanted to stage a Day of Honor celebration, the details are here. They're in the book. They're in the episode.
The wording of the guy in charge of your look back at your honor is spelled out.
It is. So I actually enjoyed the book more than the television episode because Mike made the Klingon story the centerpiece of the book. I enjoyed the way he expanded on B'Elanna's background, and we got to see how the breakup happened and her feelings about watching her parents' relationship basically just disintegrate. and the way she just had to get away from the constant, I guess, arguing and fighting and unpleasantness that was in home. And in order to do that, she stepped up. She went to a cave with a couple of other kids, and they got into some trouble in there because it was apparently volcanically active. And the person who talked Milana into going in there got herself trapped, petrified. Basically, she couldn't move, and Milana had to step up and save her. And all of that was just really great background stuff. I also appreciated learning why Ramen was so bitter and wanted to take revenge against Seven, the way that his family was assimilated right in front of him. Now, how he escaped that must have taken quite some skill, but one can certainly understand why he was so upset and wanted to take revenge on Seven of Nine over that.
I'm under a different understanding. Ramen was the first member of that species to come aboard Voyager and do the negotiations. He got what he wanted and he left. I don't believe in the book he sees Seven of Nine. It's Loomis who's the second person to come aboard Voyager of that species who actually runs in to Seven of Nine.
But Ramen was the one that made the demands, wasn't he?
No, Ramen was the one that made the demand in the TV episode, but Loomis was the one that made the demand in the book.
Okay, I will stand corrected there. Anyway, I think Mike did an awesome job of taking a subplot and making it a main story for the novelization, and he still preserved the other part of the story. The main story was about Seven, but she figured prominently, though, in the honor theme that went through the book.
I think we were seeing that in a lot of the other novels in this series, too, especially where you have a Klingon that gets exposed to another alien culture's thoughts or feelings or ways of expressing their honor.
Yes. So let's talk for a minute. Let's talk about the adventures that we had. Milana, she decided to give the ritual one more chance at Neelix's urging. And Neelix was offering himself to be a whipping boy that whenever Milana was feeling down and wanted someone to get angry at and someone to rant and rave at, he was going to be there for her. And this was after he offered her a blood pie, which is a tradition for the Day of Honor. And she kind of thought, you know, according to the book, Tom set up this whole Day of Honor program just for her. And she decided, okay, I'm going to go ahead and give it a try.
I think in the TV episode, Milana set the program up herself. But you're right. In the book, she starts it. And Tom takes over. And part of the problem that Milana has with the program is Tom actually did some research and found out what went on during the Klingon holiday and put more of that into the program that Milana was expecting.
Yeah. And so she goes into the holodeck and immediately she's put through a couple of minor trials before she goes through the major ones. And she's already had a bad day. Her sonic shower has broken down.
It not only broke down, it screamed at her.
Yeah. And we had problems in engineering with leaks here and problems there.
And Janeway dumps this Borg on her to do some sort of task that Milana really doesn't want to have to deal with.
Yeah. And and then she goes into the holodeck for her Day of Honor thing, and it isn't much better for her at that point.
No, because the whole Day of Honor ceremony is challenge after challenge after challenge.
Yeah, it just seems to be a very, very long ritual when you get into it.
I don't know if it's really that long, but, you know, you start out, why are you here? Eat this heart of a targ. Fight me. Cross this pit of lava.
Yeah. Oh, don't forget, drink this foul-smelling liquid.
Oh, that one. I had to get that targ down somehow.
Yeah. So anyway, Milana, she just says, look, this is all well and good, and you just have a really great day and have a great time. I got other things to do. And they try to stop her, and she put a whipping on them. I would say probably that an actual Klingon would have really admired her performance in battle.
Yeah, it could be. It's almost, it's interesting that an engineer trying to get out of a program wouldn't have just gone ahead and say, computer, end program.
Yeah.
Something in her mind must have said, keep this thing going.
Yeah. So to that point, we have the actual Day of Honor ritual being reviewed by B'Elanna, but we get other characters that are concerned about honor. For instance, Seven of Nine, who asks for a job. She tells Chakotay, I don't want to be in here. I spend a lot of lonely time in here. I want something to do. And when he asks her what she wants to do, she wants to work in engineering, and she's going to figure out a way to set up a transwarp conduit to get Voyager back to the Alpha Quadrant faster. With all of this stuff breaking down around engineering, they're going to try to make a major change like that, which didn't bode well for what was going to happen.
Well, I think here you're looking at B'Elanna going, okay, this Borg that has been dumped on me wants to go play this game with the computer to figure out how to do this thingy that, you know, I really don't care about. Let me just go ahead and let her do it, and then she's out of my hair.
There's the other part of that, too, where previously Seven of Nine had tried to recontact the Borg to be rescued from Voyager, and nobody's really sure about her motivations. So B'Elanna's suspicious that she's going to sabotage the ship somehow, and even Janeway is suspicious that there's going to be problems. As a matter of fact, according to what Chakotay said, everybody's a little bit worried about what Seven of Nine is capable of doing.
Yeah, and that's the thing, that Janeway goes and gives her the trust to try and get her integrated within the Voyager family, rather than just saying, no, you tried to sell us out. Stay in your damn cubicle.
Yeah. Now, Seven of Nine vowed to Janeway personally that she wouldn't try to do anything like that again. She wouldn't try to contact the Borg. She wasn't going to sabotage the ship. She gave her word, and everybody was doubting that. And it really threw Seven into kind of a tailspin, because she says, I don't know how I can fit into this way of doing things, because there's so many hidden thoughts and hidden ideas, and people don't talk about what's on their mind. And she was just really confused and not understanding where she fit in to the scheme of the whole picture.
The big problem, of course, is Janeway knows what human honor is, what giving your word as a human means. Janeway knows what giving your word as a Klingon means. Janeway knows what giving your word as a Vulcan means. Nobody knows whether Seven or Nine is closer to human or closer to Borg, let alone what does a Borg giving their word mean.
Well, as a Borg, not as someone who is recovering from being a Borg, but being a Borg, there's no word to give. All they want to do is assimilate.
See, that's the dilemma the crew is in right there. They don't know what value her word is what Seven of Nine values her word at.
True. But, you know, I felt really good about it when she was finally vindicated and she did not sabotage anything. She was not attempting to do anything nefarious. She was absolutely being on the up and up. She wanted to work on the ship, get out of her alcove, and contribute to the betterment of the Voyager.
And it gets kind of dropped and nobody talks about it whatsoever, but when Seven of Nine builds the device that can generate the thorium that the Kentati need to power their equipment, they mention, well, why didn't you tell us you could do this before? It's just a passing throwaway line that she never thought of it. And that's a major part of our thinking processes, that if something is not brought to the forefronts of our brains, we don't tend to think about them.
Well, necessity is the mother of invention, and Voyager didn't necessarily need the thorium compound in order to do what they needed to do, not as much as the Kentati did.
And I'm not going to go into where is the power source for this device, because otherwise, you know, right now it's a ex deus machina that they threw into the story rather than how do they actually make thorium out of nothing.
Well, if nothing else, it served to show the Kentati were not very honorable in some ways themselves. I mean, here we have a former Borg, someone who is recovering her humanity, who has on her own taken it upon herself to invent a machine to help them. They can duplicate it as much as they need to and provide themselves with what they need for their fuel, what they need for their replicators and everything else. And they took this machine and they never even said any kind of word of gratitude.
Yeah.
So I thought that was kind of tacky, you know. I suppose, I don't know how I'd feel if all of humanity got assimilated and I was the sole survivor of everything. I don't know if I could say thanks to the Borg either. But at the same time, if they have given me technology that would allow me to survive, I think there would be some measure of gratitude there.
Well, Jim, we will see, because right now we're in a similar situation with the coronavirus running around and everybody having to wait for scientists to come up with a vaccine, you know, magic pill for us to take to get out of our isolation. How are we going to be dealing with it? Right now, we're seeing some people not dealing with it very honorably.
No, that's very true. I heard a news flash about some guy who was using it as a weapon against someone else. I have coronavirus. I'm going to spit on you.
Oh, that's an old one. Back when AIDS first came out, somebody with AIDS would threaten other people. They actually got locked up for it.
Yeah. Oh, so did this person that tried to do the same thing with a store clerk. I don't know all the circumstances. I just heard a clip about it.
Look how many protests are going on about having to do the right thing and stay in social isolation in our own little Kentati ships until the scientists have beaten the virus.
Well, yeah. I mean, there are a lot of people that are just absolutely being socially irresponsible. They're not taking it seriously and living right on the edge, and it's kind of dangerous when it is so easy to take precautions.
And I think that's what makes Star Trek such a powerful set of series. Even an episode or a book like this that has nothing to do, it's written decades before this virus ever came out, has things to tell us about what we're going through right now.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the Day of Honor itself. You enjoy some Rokeg blood pie, and next you enter the caves of Kalis. And it's very dark. It seems to be a rather uncomfortable place.
Yes. At that point, you're going to confront Muklor, the interrogator, who, well, I don't have it on this particular sheet. First things he does is ask you why you are here. Then you are supposed to eat the heart of a sanctified targ. Now, it doesn't spell it out here, but my guess would be you're supposed to eat the raw heart, because that's how most Klingons prepare their food. The chef on a Klingon ship, the actual term translates to butcher, not cooking guy. You drink this matlock, which is that smelly drink you were talking about earlier. They throw the line out. Kalis defeated his enemies on the field of battle and built a mighty empire. How have you proven yourself worthy of the name Klingon?
So what would be a good answer to that question? I mean, B'Elanna is on Voyager. She's doing her job. She's doing her job very well. She steps up when she's called upon to perform well in battle, which she usually does. And she's just kind of at a loss for how to answer this.
Because she's never had to think in these terms. But how would the engineer on a Klingon vessel answer the same question? He would talk about what he has done to keep the vessel going through a battle with, fill in the blank, defeating this particular enemy, taking out these shipyards, all while keeping the performance of his ship worthy of a Klingon attack vessel.
And certainly embellishing stories quite a bit in order to heighten that glorious behavior.
I really wish all you Klingons out there listening to this, take up the cause of taking your tales, your adventures, and writing them up so that you can deliver the tall tales that you have done through your lives. Regale the people at a convention. Regale the audience at your event. Tell them of the deeds you have done. Extol the virtues of your existence. Praise your comrades. Soapbox, hopping off of.
Well, you know, we've seen it. I've seen it at least before in books that I've read about Klingons. I mean, if you fight four enemies, when you tell this story the next time, they were 10. And the time after that, they were 18. And the time after that, they were 24. You make these stories bigger and more legendary as they go along.
And as a Klingon, you're expected to do that. So there's no dishonor in excelling at your virtues.
No, of course not.
But after you've answered the challenge, you have to go on and go through the ritual of the 20 pain sticks. Think about that. Every year, you've got to endure 20 pain sticks, whereas for your rite of ascension, you only had to deal with 8. You have to engage in combat with a Daha master in the Batleth, and then you must transverse the sulfurous lagoons of Goroth, which I assume are replicated elsewhere. Otherwise, you know, you'd have one hell of a pilgrimage every year.
Yeah, I would imagine. I don't know. Does this sound reasonable?
Does this sound what?
Does this ritual sound reasonable, something to go through every single year?
Unless you are a diehard Klingon. No, I don't think so.
Because We've talked before about the Day of Honor, where it is a day to reflect on your behavior as a warrior. And are you worthy of having that title? And this just seems to be way out there.
It might be one of those events that's like your pilgrimage to Mecca. You're expected to do it once in your lifetime.
Now that seems reasonable. I could say yes, that is reasonable.
But still, I could see something like this easily enacted on stage at a convention. Okay, the sulfurous lagoons of Gorath are probably just going to be a colored sheet that you throw on the stage. The battle with the Batless would probably just be a mock battle, the way you do a mock battle with Molar in the... I'm drawing a blank on the name of that festival, but the Klingon Festival, where you reenact the battle of Molar and Kalis. And the 20 pain sticks, well, you just use the same pain sticks you used in Rites of Ascension, and there you go.
Yeah. So what about, let's talk about some of the concepts in this book. They are, we talk about traditions. Why are traditions important?
And as we just talked about, how real are the traditions? I'm pretty sure B'Elanna believes she's supposed to go through this every year. But B'Elanna was not necessarily raised by a lot of Klingons. I think her mother was raising her on a human colony, wasn't she?
I believe that's correct.
Which means she, like Worf, has a overactive imagination as to how often these traditions take place.
That's interesting you bring up Worf, because Worf would go through this every year. I could picture him doing this every year, going into the holodeck, setting up the, setting everything up, removing the fail safes or the safety measures on the holodeck and going through this. And B'Elanna's just the exact opposite. It's like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah. And somewhere in between is what the average, everyday, run-of-the-mill Klingon believes and does.
Yes. So why are people important? You have that down on our list.
Why do traditions matter if people are not there?
I have not put a great deal of stock in many traditions. I understand why they're in place. They help to ground us. But I found some traditions that are outmoded and outdated, and they just don't work anymore.
A lot of human traditions are almost there to control us and our behaviors around other people.
Ah. Well, manners are always important, at least to humans.
But what are manners, if not traditions?
So your third point under concept brings me to a question that I think we've discussed a little bit before, but I don't think we ever came to a conclusion. How do you look at your life as honorable or not? You know, what is the measuring stick you use when you're doing the reflection for the Day of Honor? What measuring stick do you use to decide whether you have been honorable or not?
Now, this brings me back to an episode of Red Dwarf. There was an episode of Red Dwarf where a alien entity came aboard the ship who was going to judge the four members of the crew as to whether or not their life had meaning, whether or not they had led a meaningful, worthwhile life. Well, the hologram, Rimmer, was kind of a mean bully who was incompetent, couldn't get anything done. But the entity judged him as being the best version of himself that he could be because he had all the limitations built into his person. The alien looked at the cat, who was vain, not worried about other people, looking out for himself. Judge the cat. Now, the cat was a humanoid person by this point. Judge the cat as being, again, the best person that he could possibly be. He looked at the android, came to the same conclusion, overlooking the flaws of the android. But then he came to the main character, Lister, who was bright. He cared about people. He could get things done. But he judged Lister as failing to lead a meaningful life because Lister didn't live up to his potential. So if you're going to look at your life as honorable or not, it's going to be an individual determination for each person as how they can be honorable with the talents that they have.
That sounds very reasonable. So if you are being the best person you can possibly be, you are deemed honorable. I like that. All right. So what was your favorite point of the plot in this story?
One of the things that I'm looking for is to find activities and things for people, for members of CAG to do at conventions or events. So my favorite points of this plot are the actual descriptions that Michael gives of the Day of Honor activities, spelling out the ceremony that goes into making up this particular Klingon tradition.
Okay, fair enough. And there is plenty of information here. It would require, I believe, some improvisation to actually do the things, since there is no actual thing on Earth, at least as a targ. But I'm sure that a person with some imagination could come up with some of the items needed for this celebration.
If you wanted to keep it simple, you probably could even just take a heart mold and fill it with Jell-O and have a Jell-O targ heart.
Oh, well, there's an idea. My favorite point of plot in this is the way that Mike took B'Elanna's story, expanded on it, and made it the centerpiece of the book when it was only a subplot in the actual episode. And I really appreciate that happening here.
But they kind of had to do that because he's including it. I mean, the whole title of the book is Day of Honor. That says the book is supposed to be about B'Elanna or Klingons, or in some way, shape, or form, Klingon tradition.
Yes. And they did a great job. How would you rate this book, John?
Like I say, it's better than the other one in the series, given the other one Michael wrote in the series, and given the detail that has gone into the ceremony, probably a 4 or 4.5 out of 5 on this particular book.
Yes, I agree. I was going to go with a 4.5 on this also. So shall we move ahead? Let's move ahead to the final book of the Day of Honor series, titled Honor Bound by Diana G. Gallagher, and published in 1997, October of 97. And I'll go ahead and turn it over to you to give us a summary of the plot.
There is no occasion more sacred to Klingons than the Day of Honor. To a Klingon youth, honor is a lesson, hard learned and harder earned. The hunter instinct is taking over Alexander, driving him to violence when he can't learn to control his emerging Klingon traits. He's in trouble at school when his father, Worf, gives his word as a Starfleet officer that Alexander's behavior will change. But it takes a frightening confession from Worf before Alexander understands he must learn to control himself or lose everything he loves. A Klingon is honor bound to keep his word at any cost, and Alexander is about to pay the price as he faces disgrace and dishonor for challenging his bully classmates with character instead of force.
A pretty accurate description of the book. My overall impressions for this book is it is most definitely a young adult book. I would actually say an upper elementary to junior high aged kid would enjoy it and get the most out of it. Although, me reading it, I was entertained. But especially if this young person is being bullied or is having trouble at home with parental support, I think this book would be beneficial to them.
Well, I kind of thought it was odd in reading the book how much actual support Alexander did get. He was believed quite a bit by Worf and his grandparents when he related what he would relate about the incidents.
Yes. Well, and he had to earn that, and he was not getting any support at school. It all came from Worf, which was kind of unexpected, considering that there were some incidents on board the Enterprise that were kind of troublesome.
Yeah. But then again, the teachers, the librarian, the principals, even today, if a person is being bullied in school, there are two possibilities. One, the person being bullied does nothing about it and has to accept the blame. Two, the person being bullied takes it out on the bullies, fights back, and then everybody gets blamed. But either way, the kid who's getting bullied will get punished.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So anyway, we have Alexander, as you said, is having some trouble at school, and it's coming down basically to a racist problem. And what was the racism caused by in this case, John?
He was a Klingon.
But wasn't there a particular incident that made the Klingons, you know, even more so hated?
I think this particular story was taking place during the human Klingon skirmishes of DS9 after Day of the Warrior and before the Dominion War.
Okay, so Alexander is catching, well, let's just say it, he's catching crap from three guys who want him gone. They want him out of the school. They want him kicked out, expelled, and not allowed back. And they are making life absolutely miserable for Alexander, who is trying to mind his own business and get through school and do what he needs to do to make things easiest on himself.
And his parents, and his grandparents, and the school. He's looking out for everybody, and all these three guys are trying to do is get him booted out permanently.
Yep. And then Alexander is informed that Worf is coming for a visit, and Alexander is not excited about this at all.
Because he knows how his father feels about duty and honor.
Well, not only duty and honor, but Worf was kept pushing him and pushing him and pushing him to become a warrior, and Alexander made it very clear, I don't want to be a warrior, I want to be something else.
And I think that's interesting because he was saying all this, not wanting to be a warrior, before his, I guess for lack of a better term, hormones started kicking in and giving him the violent tendency.
Yes, heightening his temper and beginning to make him feel like he should be physically displaying what's going on. Now, you know, can you imagine what it would be like to be a Klingon child, 12 or 13 years old, in the middle of a bunch of humans and trying to stop these tendencies from happening? I mean, being human and going through this part of your life is already difficult enough, let alone being Klingon and part human, and going through even more of this could be just absolutely miserable.
And I think that's the key, because we don't know enough about Klingon physiology to know how strong these hormonal reactions are to the characters of the Klingon.
Now, this is really the only idea we get that there could be problems. So Alexander is growing up. He's trying to cope with this stuff. Worf is coming. Alexander's not happy about it. But when Worf gets there, we see a different Worf than we have seen previously dealing with Alexander. It would seem that this Worf in the book, it has accepted that Alexander is going to lead his own life, and they actually behave more like two equals than they do a father and son.
Or we're seeing Worf through Alexander's eyes. So Alexander is becoming more and more the violent Klingon that needs to be taken on the hunt, that needs to be trained in how to deal with all of these new emotions that are raging in him. And he's starting to see his father for more of what his father has grown into. And it's Alexander's perception of Worf that has changed. And it's those eyes that we're now seeing the character of Worf through. Worf has always been this kind of calm until you provoke him type of character. I didn't think Worf's reactions in this book were more stark than what you normally see Worf as. But taken from Alexander's perspective, they're a touch different.
Okay. Yeah. So at any rate, Alexander gives his word that he is not going to create problems. He's going to do the best he can to control himself, using Worf as an example of how this is possible to do. And Alexander makes a huge attempt to do this. But these three boys, Umbaya, Sullivan, and Ho, they are not going to give up. They absolutely are not going to quit, and they're going to push Alexander to the breaking point, or at least they're going to try to.
Well, when they get away with the library stunt and Alexander doesn't rat on them, they know they can push him at the soccer field. And if they can get him into a fight, they know he's gone.
Yeah, well, that's what they thought, but it didn't quite work out that way.
No, but only because Worf stepped in and did some finagling and understanding of his own to see what was going on.
Okay. And the solution to this entire problem was somewhat interesting. It was a gymnastics match. Apparently the three bullies were all on the gymnastics team. They were all quite talented. Alexander also had talents with gymnastics, but never joined the team because he didn't feel like he was going to be accepted. So they set up a gymnastics competition on the Day of Honor so that Alexander can prove himself worthy.
Alexander had to challenge the three boys to a Subak, to prove his innocence. Trial by competition, but Alexander got to choose the competition. So instead of choosing Batless, where, quite frankly, he would, you know, kill the kids, he chose a gymnastics event. Now, as I recall, one of the boys was on the gymnastics team, but the other two had training from the gym classes that were available at the high school they were going to.
Okay. So at any rate, the competition was close. Alexander was victorious, and then the three boys, seeing Alexander's talent, all decided to let up on him, and the four of them wound up being friends. And that was kind of interesting. It's kind of the turnout one would expect from a young adult book, that yes, Alexander is triumphant and actually comes out of it better than he actually should have.
Yeah, and unfortunately to me, that kind of read wrong, and I just couldn't believe the turnaround in the characters of those three bullies.
But, you know, at the same time, I can see this happening this way. If they made it into an after-school special, for instance, on for television, I could absolutely see this unfolding exactly the way it did in the book, being resolved very quickly. My daughter, for instance, she watches these American Girl movies, and they are all the same formula as this book is, where there's a person who has a talent, they wind up with rivals, they have little spats along the way, and there's some nasty stuff going on, and then at the end of the show, everybody's friends, and everybody has an understanding. This is a typical formulaic story that ends with a happy ending.
And unfortunately, the only show similar to that that I watch, you have high school students, they get into a tiff, Buffy drives a stake through the vampire's heart, and everything's settled.
So, we have, for the adventures, we've got the fight at the airport, the destruction of Alexander in his rage. He destroys one of his grandma's rose bushes, and he feels horrible about that. And that is when Worf goes looking for him. Now, in this book, Worf tells a more complete story in the book than we get in the episode where we find out that Worf, or where we learn that Worf accidentally killed a friend in a soccer match because he was being overly aggressive. And he tells this story to Alexander, and there's more of it in the book than there was in the episode where Worf alluded to that.
Yeah, I just watched that episode the other night again. It's a DS9 episode. He's talking to Dax, and it really is another one of those quickie things that the writers have put in. That's almost a throwaway story that in this case pans out into be a longer story, a more detailed story in the written word.
And it became a major plot point in the story to help motivate Alexander to behave in a more restrained manner. Well, I kind of enjoyed it reading it. I read young adult fiction on occasion. Sometimes I even get contacted by authors to read their book and kind of give them some feedback about what I think. I think my favorite point of plot for this particular book was that the way that Alexander was dreading Worf's visit, because he believed that Worf was going to show up and start pushing him to become a warrior. But as the book went on, Worf never lost faith in Alexander, stood by him all the way, and believed Alexander when he gave his word that he was not going to be the cause of trouble. Even though he was accused a couple of times of being the cause of the problem or being the whole problem, Worf stood by his kid and made sure that justice was done correctly. So anyway, we have the theme of honor, and we have Alexander behaving honorably, everybody behaving honorably. The three bullies eventually turned themselves around and became honorable. We have Alexander demonstrating how he did keep his word as best he possibly could, as much as he was allowed to. So there we go. Do you have any closing thoughts?
Well, what really surprised me was, well, you know how short this particular story is. I think it was like, what, 60 pages?
Yeah, it wasn't very long at all.
They turned it into an actual standalone novel when it was first published. And that was surprising to me. It had its own cover and everything. I've seen references to it on Alpha Memory or one of those Star Trek sites out there that keep the history of the franchise going. So it was kind of surprising being so sure. At first, I thought it had been written simply to be tacked into the omnibus. But here it is, its own standalone book.
Yeah. And it was, and I thought it was very good for a young person's book to read. I think there's a moral to the story. I think that there are all the elements that a young person could use to find something to grasp hold of. So I'm going to rate this book. I'm going to give it a 5 as a young person's reading, something they could read and enjoy and actually get something out of.
And I'll have to defer to you because I don't read that many young person's books. So my first thought has to be, is that about the average size of a young person's book? And I've got a couple of pieces of Diane's artwork hanging on my walls here. So I know that the artwork in that book is her style.
Oh yeah, I did. I also wanted to comment on that, on the artwork, and it is absolutely spot on accurate. I mean, the characters look like who they are in the TV show, Alexander and Worf. It's very well drawn, and there isn't an overwhelming a lot of pictures in there, but the ones that are there are well done.
Approximately one per chapter.
Yes. So, what are we going to be looking at next time?
Your closing thoughts.
Oh, my closing thoughts? As I said,
you gave it a 5 out of 5, but thoughts?
Well, as I said, I think it is a very good book for a young person to read, say between 6th grade and 8th grade. I think they would actually enjoy it. I think they would enjoy the fact that Alexander comes out on top. He's the underdog. He's got 3 people who are trying to get him kicked out of school. And not only that, he's got adults that he has to deal with, the principal, the librarian, various other teachers that are really down on him. And he has a whole lot of things to overcome, which he does with the help of Worf. And I just think that's a triumphant story that might inspire a young person to behave honorably.
Okay, well, next month we're going to look at, we're going to go back to a series of books that we started some time ago. They are more recently written books, part of the Prey series. We'll be looking at books 2 next month and 3 the month after that.
Yeah, so we're going to finish up that series, and that gives us a couple of months to figure out where to go from there. So, of course, you can find us wherever podcasts are available. You can find us on kag.org/podcast. Please send us feedback at podcast@kag.org, and let us know what your thoughts are. So for Bound by Honor,
tell us some books to read.
Yeah. And so for Bound by Honor, I am Jajim.
And I am Jorn.
Kapla! You have been listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Bound by Honor is brought to you by the Klingon Assault Group and is produced by Admiral Kurg Zantai Loon Keej. If you hear the call of the warrior, visit our homepage at www.kag.org to learn more about what it means to be Klingon. Perhaps you have what it takes to be one of us. Listener feedback is always welcome at podcast@kag.org. Kaplop!